So the retreat may come to an end, almost, and life goes on. There were quite a number of questions about this aspect. So I'd like to answer a few questions that came into my note. And it really is a matter of understanding that every aspect of our life, as I've said quite a number of times actually, touches this field of Dharma, of wisdom, of teaching of the Buddha. What we have done actually is just dedicating time to see the reality of each moment. It's not much, and it's a lot. So it really is interesting how actually everything is present, right? We have the discernment, we have the understanding, we have the wisdom. These qualities are here. Yet we just need to have the space, the time, the interest to support these qualities. And when we support them, they grow. So we've basically really helped seeing awareness, presence, mindfulness, quality of wisdom, discernment, making the effort, which naturally is something that we need because so much of the time we're spacing out. And we've also touched upon what it could mean to have a little bit more loving kindness, a quality of compassion. So now this wish, you know, we have this sense of kind of separation, fragmentation, right? So we may have had some understanding and idea that what we found valuable is going to be stored up here, staying here in this location, until maybe I meet myself the next time on the next retreat and find myself in the same situation, and in between, go on with my life. The usual way. The habits and the rush and the getting lost. So it may be useful to really find a way that we can bring in the interest to maybe not do that. Because so much of what is happening within our life is exactly about that. I move on. Tomorrow morning, I'm still here. Tomorrow afternoon, computer. Listen deeply. See how you're receptive when you open your computer tomorrow. Remember, maybe. Pause. Relax. Open. But really, this is exactly what we can do for ourselves, right? So, do we have this understanding that retreat life is not about real life? Is real life something else? Are we someone else? It's amazing how we create these separations. And these separations are exactly the cause for pain, and then we say, oh, but this practice, it doesn't really work, you know. Why not? So are these teachings compatible with our lives, with the flow of our lives, with being, interacting with people? Yes, absolutely. So if we have this understanding, there's a way we can bring some openness, really sense that it's a valuable thing that we can bring to each and every moment. One of the great Tibetan masters, the Karmapa, 16th. He said, the great strength of this practice is that exactly that, it can be carried everywhere. Everywhere. It's alive every moment, even, he said, amidst the worldly activities. So how do we make this practice become a way of life? He said, you just need to remember. You just need to remember that it can be carried everywhere. That it can be something that you have available. Every moment, we can remember to be aware rather than lost. To be wise rather than in aversion, in anger. So this is extraordinary, actually. So we have a choice. You know, every moment we have a choice. And actually, this practice is quite engaging. I've been finding, now it's been like, you know, 30 years, I think, this year, that I'm practicing. And there's a way that I'm finding it so rich after all this time. It's just fantastic to have that value. How many things in my life do I still find rich? Practicing really quite consistently for 30 years. There's so many things that I took to heart and then, you know, just left. But this keeps on growing, a growing interest. Why? Because the beauty of a human being can manifest. We can find value. And it is of service to any circumstance, even the hardest ones. So this is quite extraordinary. So what is the choice? The choice is that we take it along. And what happens is that when wisdom is strengthened, it simply grows and we become happier. So it's very important to understand that it's not just being present, as I said very early on in the retreat. You know, this kind of attention where we're just attentive. But there's a whole way that we can bring in some interest to what's happening when I'm present. What is happening in relationship to a mind that may be craving something, reactive to somebody saying something? To really check the attitude of mind with which you are being present. That's where the jewel lies. It's actually the secret. Because of course, being present, yeah, and so what? It's the next one. But thank you. Oh yes, thank you so much. This is more pleasant. So, the same teacher said, if you have 100%, which is a lot, right? 100% is mean full, right? Dedication in the teachings, then every life situation can be part of the practice. This means that you live with the practice everywhere. So, we can trust that it's a possibility, okay? And it may be a high aspiration to have that be, but at least to go in that direction, right? That we really trust that we can live from that ground of interest, connection, rather than noticing how we feed the rivers. Because we know a lot. And we know what's good for us. It's just so amazing that we do know what's good for us. And yet so many times we get caught in not taking that perspective. May I take what's good for me? May I take loving kindness rather than the judging mind? It's amazing how we can be, in a way, totally distorted. So we implement this truth. Now, there's a way that we need to understand the difference between craving and aspiration. And this is one of the questions that came up. Actually, a few people maybe didn't understand this, and I'd like to give a little bit of time in relationship to this. There's wholesome intention, right? Which leads to wholesome action or wholesome activity. We're conscious, we're present, and we are really engaging to go in a direction where we implement what we are learning here. The way we relate and live from that place of, yes, I know what's beneficial, what supports my well-being, and I definitely go in that field. So desire is inherent in the human condition. We're born to grow. You see a little kid, and it's full of energy, that very clear energy of life energy. So this is not something that we want to suppress, not at all. It's growth, it's creativity. It's inconceivable in my mind that we suppress desires. And I think there's a real sense that we need to understand what this means. Anyone wishing to live a wise life needs to explore deeply him or her kind of relationship and foundation for desire. Right? So there's a number of myths in relationship actually to the Buddha Dharma or to Buddhist practice saying, oh, desire is bad. You know? All desire, we don't need to have anything to do with desire. And I think it's a wrong understanding. There's a very clear type of desire, which is called craving, that is the cause for suffering. And I talked about that the other night, right? And there's a desire that leads all the way to liberation. There's no doubt that the Buddha had a lot of desire. He talked even about spiritual urgency, right? Samvega, like there's no time to lose here, right? Time is precious. And we fuel the effort. We really put ourselves into motion in relationship to fulfilling this activity of ours. Right? So it's a wrong understanding. It's like kind of a myth, actually, to think that life without desire is a good thing. Actually, I feel that today there's so many people that are living with quite some despair and depression, and actually for that base, that there's kind of a sense of lack of meaning, right? And a life without desire is not necessarily a good thing. It can be exactly a symptom of depression to have no desires at all. It's like, what's the worth? Right? So there's a way that we have to differentiate to make really the understanding and again the wisdom. What is the starting point for understanding desire? Well, there is healthy desire, one that is definitely bringing something which is totally wholesome, actively beneficial for the world, and some desires that are not so creative, that definitely cause suffering, right? So how do we know? How do we know? It's not so easy to know. I've questioned myself a lot around this, you know, in relationship to living my life and in the moment, like, what choice do I make? What choice do I make in relationship to this? Well, the way that I can see this is that there's a way that we have a sense of purpose, we have an aspiration, the heart yearns for something beneficial. And when we are in connection, like we have been maybe a few moments or a lot of moments, I wish for you, with this aspiration of the heart that is just free from wanting, this craving, right? Attachment and not wanting, right? This sense of kind of craving for pleasure, wanting, comfort, well-being. And is creating stress inside, really a sense of tension and contraction, is manifesting from that type of desire, then we know, wow, this is not really pleasant, actually. There's a state of imbalance, right? So the wholesome desire will have something where the energy is pretty balanced. There's creativity, there's energy, there's really a strength and some deep, deep yearning to accomplish maybe a very beautiful and noble activity for ourself and maybe for the world. So there's a way that we absolutely know the difference. Now, how do we know? Just when we are aware and not lost. This is exactly how we will know. If there's a sense of connection, a sense of really being in contact, we know the difference and we have the wisdom to discern. I think it's so helpful that we recognize that we have that value, that we can make that difference, and we all know that this is possible, right? So we need to really make a difference between craving and aspiration. So when I spoke of trust emergence, this is a reply to a question again, you know, just trust what emerges, right? Meaning that we are allowing ourselves to feel exactly what is happening within our momentary inner life or in relationship to something outside. We can trust that aspiration can emerge. We can trust that there's a way that we are leading our life in a way that we know which action to take. And if there's a sense of purpose, as I talked, maybe, like, I'm very concerned about the climate situation, and that's why I brought it up, actually. Because this is really something of a very clear, I mean, not to worry, there's not need for worry, but concern, that we can maybe bring about our sense of aspiration to act in relationship to this. So trust emergence doesn't mean I'm passive and there's no interest and who cares, you know? There's nothing to do. Not at all. It's, may I take the wholesome action from that place of balanced mindfulness, equanimity, not from the place of aversion and harm and, you know, let me go there and create a conflict, but really allow myself to feel this is moving me. So this is a movement and the energy wants to manifest and fuel my activity in life in relationship to that. And we do it with all our heart and stay balanced. So it doesn't mean that this mindfulness practice is just being present and not being involved in life. Not at all. It means we do take action, but from a place where we are steady, from a place where we know what is beneficial, from a place that will support the awareness and the kindness. So this is really allowing our strength of heart with wisdom to manifest. And it's so beautiful when this happens. And in a way, I see that completely linked to Dharma inactivity. It's Dharma inaction. And so it's maybe a very good thing that we begin to have a sense where we can put into action what we feel is appropriate for ourselves. And not only have this practice be a contemplation. Now, no doubt we need to have some sense of wisdom, right? To be able to act appropriately. Wise action. So it's very helpful then to have a way that we do come into ourselves, deepen really our strength of understanding, connect deeply with ourselves as we have been doing. So we know. Where is the place of imbalance? Where is the place of grasping? Where is the place of compulsion when we want to act? What's the drive? Right? Is there clinging? Is there tension, pressure, an attachment to a result? And so we know. We connect. And therefore we can have a way that maybe there is a craving for something to happen in relationship to any cause we may be concerned by. And we allow for that to be known. Oh, this is what's happening. Right? So this force also of craving very clearly today leads to addiction. Actually, it's amazing how we would probably call this word craving today the force of addiction. When we are in a state of addiction, whatever the addiction, right? It can be video games. It can be anything, right? Looking at our cell phone for a million times, it's amazing. You know, this thing, like it's the compulsion, right? I don't know if you, have you been 5 days without looking at your cell phone? Good. Wow, that's going to be something when you take that device and look at it. Right, so it can happen anywhere, but it's amazing. It's the compulsion. It's just like, wow, what is this for? And you know, I know it. So I'm talking from experience here, right? It's amazing, but it does touch everybody, right? And I can see how, wow, I can judge myself for that. But it has a cost. Craving has a cost, you know? So there's no doubt that what the cost is that if it's really a compulsion and we can't live without, then of course it's suffering. No doubt, right? So they're very useful, these little devices, right? And some entertainment can be very pleasurable. So it's not about, right, kind of this ideal, abstract life where we are hearing that, you know, we should have pleasure in life. But it's completely another thing when it becomes an addiction and how easily it can get one, right? So there's physical tension. Constant wanting can really exhaust the mind. And a lot of energy actually is lost in relationship to this. Right? If we are tired, and very, very tired and constantly exhausted, it's probably because we don't give enough space to feel the energy level that's available. Left unchecked, craving can lead really to a sense of exhaustion. How many people today have burnouts? You know, it's amazing how there's a sense that we just can't keep up with the pace. And it's normal. It's just so normal. There's a way that the body, thank goodness that there's a body, says, wait, here, enough. Rest. Ease. Pause. So it's amazing because what's happening is that we are trying to, with our craving, kind of reach a state where there's an unchecked relationship where we are in a relationship where consciously or unconsciously or someone else, some idea of someone else, the society or your boss is asking you to function like a machine. And this is really very, very exhausting. So the Dharma, I mean the practice, is really asking us to look at this more closely, because the frustration and the aspect of being really separated from ourself, from our deep yearning, from our deep quality of being, in balance, is something which will cause suffering. So the Dharma has an effect here on every single aspect of our life. Right? We can really sense that after 5 days, wow, you do regain a little bit of balance and strength and joy maybe and calm and it's quite amazing actually that it happens pretty quickly, thank goodness, you know. It doesn't take a year to recuperate. And so, yeah, wow, we feel just a little lighter and more in balance, more connected to nature. And so the mind finds again balance. We do not need to lose this. So this is a priority. I really feel that for people to have a conscious life, it's a priority. And it may mean saying no. Having the courage to say no to a situation with wisdom. It takes responsibility and sensitivity to be able to really allow ourselves then to have a sense of respect, because it is about respect and care. And in the same way, we can hold ourselves with the satisfaction and wonderful capacity to move forward and to have our healthy aspirations fulfilled. So much more creativity in our life. And happiness, of course. This is the outcome. So it's a whole process, right? This process that we've been engaging in is naturally something which flourishes moment by moment. Right? It can only be kind of fulfilled when you are in contact, and you are in contact in each and every moment. Right? What happened yesterday is gone. Tomorrow, who knows? We're not yet there. We have this moment. This is the moment where we can really sense and feel. And it's helpful to choose and decide maybe one place or one aspiration, as I invited you to. Where is it that you would like to place your aspiration? Change maybe a habit of craving or compulsion, drive of the habit mode or patterns that we have in relationship to aspiration. It can be helpful. I have been for quite some time now, I mean it's been years, where I've had the intention, not that I'm an unkind person, but to really meet the situations with kindness. This was kind of a very clear, wholesome aspiration, a wholesome intention, and it was amazing how it felt challenging. Not so much with other beings, with myself. Because as many people, there was this tendency, this pattern of not enough, right? Which was pushing, of course, then the craving, right? Craving to be better, craving to do more. As if I was doing more was giving the sense, this being, a better quality. It was just giving exhaustion and naturally a lot of judgment when it wasn't happening. Right? So it's fascinating to notice how challenging it can be. So meeting life with as much as kindness as I can. And it's a beautiful way that you can really sense whatever aspiration you have. It requires, actually, a better quality of presence to know. Did I meet this person with kindness? Did I meet my mind state with kindness? Yes, no, sometimes very challenging, I tell you. And to have the willingness to be kind when it's not fulfilled. That when there is anger, oh, anger feels like this. I got angry, okay. Don't need to judge myself. We don't need to judge ourselves. It's just a way that maybe anger is an expression of some deeper emotional state, as I said, and we just allow ourselves to process that. So we often have the idea that loving kindness and awareness, there's two separate practices. You know, it's just like so many times, and for a long time actually, we would do the Vipassana practice and then suddenly, oh yes, this metta practice just on the side, you know. And it felt like secondary, right? Really. And for many people it's like, oh, so artificial, the phrases and not really meaningful, until really we sense maybe at one point, wow, this kindness really has an effect on the mindfulness. Because how can one be mindful, I mean really mindful, and not have this quality of allowing? The kindness is not something extreme, extraordinary. It's just an acceptance of what is. It's an openness. It's really a way that we are allowing rather than closing down. That's how kindness manifests. So they're not two separate things. And the more we touch, as I said, deep down in ourselves, the more we're going to be in touch with the heart. And no doubt that heartfulness may hold this sense of aspiration in relationship to allowing. And it's actually an unconditional acceptance that holds us to fulfill our aspirations. This is what it's about. One line of a 14th century Zen samurai poem says, I make my mind my friend. This is the line that inspired me, actually. I make my mind my friend. So how can we make our mind our friend? Can you imagine what it means? Rather than have self-judgment or self-aversion or constant anger that we feed against ourselves, we make our mind our friend by paying attention, by being receptive, by just feeling what is happening and attending even to the anger, even to the aversion, to the judgment, to the reverse, with friendliness, at the same place. So it's a process. Oh, there's anger. It's not about never having anger. There is anger. There is a sense maybe of self-doubt or unworthiness. Make friends. We allow, and therefore we don't contract. We don't crave for something else. We can bring this quality of kind-hearted attention even to our struggles. And that's realistic. It's amazingly beautiful because it changes the attitude. It may not change the conditions, but it changes the relationship to what is happening. And therefore we grow in willingness, wisdom, and compassion in those moments. So kindness and awareness, they're definitely not two separate things. The sixth Zen patriarch, you know, he was the founding teacher of the Chan tradition. Do you know Chan, Chinese? Yeah? He said, do not think kindness and awareness are two separate things. Awareness is the foundation of kindness, and kindness is the expression of awareness. So kindness being the expression of awareness, we are moved then to fulfill our aspiration and offer that generosity of heart. And it's amazing because this is just so far back. And now you know that a lot of research is happening around compassion and empathy in relationship to neuroscience, right? Everything that they're seeing. There's a big field of study in neuroscience and many, many books you can find in relationship to this aspect of how we can actually change, shift our brain, shift in a way our kind of, you can say, neuropaths, right? And the primary building block for empathy and compassion is mindfulness. So the fact that if we're aware, if we cultivate this quality that we've been cultivating in each and every moment, spontaneously it changes the tracks and we find the wonderful, beautiful quality for compassion, empathy, and kindness. So it's a process. The more we find it for ourselves, the more we're going to have the capacity to relate from that place, to really also bring it out in the world. It's interconnectedness. The less there's selfishness, the sense of me grasping at what I want, which is, of course, craving, me, there's just a greater field of sensory experience where it's maybe not so much based in self, but in being, and being in connection with another, interconnectedness. So I'd like to read a story which really describes kind of a process of how this can happen. And it's a book that's called The Joy of Living from Mingyur Rinpoche, and he speaks of his neighbor. He says, "I have a Tibetan friend in India who lived next door to a man who had a bad-tempered dog. In India, unlike other countries, the walls surrounding the front yard of a house are very tall with doors instead of gates. The entrances to my friend's yard and his neighbor's yard were very close, and every time my friend came out of his door, the dog would come out of his neighbor's door barking. Altogether, it was a very scary experience for my friend. As if there weren't bad enough, the dog had also developed a habit of pushing through the door into my friend's yard, again barking, making a terrible disturbance. My friend spent a long time considering how to punish the dog for its bad behavior. At last, he had an idea. For propping open the door to his front yard just a bit and loosely piling a few small heavy objects on top of it. Meaning that the next time the dog pushed open the door, the objects would fall, teaching him a painful lesson he would never forget. After setting his trap, one Saturday morning, my friend sat by his front window watching and waiting for the dog to enter the yard. Time passed, the dog never came. After a while, my friend said out his daily prayer text, right? Tibetan, they pray. Started chanting, glancing up from his text every once in a while to look out the window into the yard. Still, the dog did not appear. At a certain point in his chanting, he came to a very ancient prayer of aspiration known as metta practice. So he was repeating and chanting the prayer, "May all sentient beings have happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering." We know, huh? These lines. We chant them in the evening. In the middle of the chanting, it suddenly occurred to him that the dog was a sentient being, and that in having deliberately set a trap, he would put the dog into pain and suffering. So if I chant this is a true story. He thought, I'll be lying. Maybe I should stop chanting. So you can understand that this is a whole process, right? But that didn't feel right, since the prayer was part of his daily practice. So he started the prayer again, making an effort to develop compassion towards dogs. But halfway through, he stopped himself thinking, no, that dog is very bad. He causes me a lot of harm. Actually, I don't want him to be free of suffering. It's such a way that we are laughing, because we all know this, right? So he thought about his problem for a while until the solution finally came to him. He was going to change just one line of the prayer. May some sentient beings have happiness. May some sentient beings be free from suffering. And he felt quite happy with this solution. After he finished his prayers, eaten his lunch, and forgotten about the dog, he decided to go out for a walk. And in his haste, in his rush, he forgot about the trap, and soon he pulled open the door to his yard, all the heavy things piled upon his head. It was a rude awakening. Yet, as a result of his pain, he realized something of a great importance. My friend realized, says Mingyo Rinpoche, that by excluding any beings from the possibility of achieving happiness and freedom from suffering, he had also excluded himself. Recognizing that he himself was the victim of his own lack of compassion, he decided to change his way. The next day he went out for his morning walk, had a piece of tsampa, which is a kind of dough. It's Tibetan, some kind of ground of barley, right? And he had salt, and he had lumps of butter that Tibetans usually eat for breakfast. And the dog appeared, rushing out, barking. But instead of cursing the dog, he offered the dog the piece of food. Completely surprised, in mid-flight, the dog caught the food in his mouth and began to chew. This little game continued over the next several days, and what my friend noticed, that even though it kept growling while chewing, this dog started to wag its tail. By the end of the week, the dog was no longer bouncing out ready to attack, but instead ran out to greet my friend, happily expecting a treat. The relationship between the two of them developed to the point where the dog would come trotting quietly into my friend's yard to sit with him in the sun. It's a beautiful story, isn't it? I mean, so true, so real, and exactly what needs to happen in our own process as we relate with kindness and awareness. So we see how here the kindness and the awareness are really melting, right? Moved to aspire to do the exact cause for action that is beneficial. We are not separate, right? What we think we do as harm to another is actually that harmful to ourselves. It's interconnected. So this is exactly where we can find that we may begin with a lot of anger like this guy, right? And it can shift. There's a sense of craving, and it can shift to aspiration and then taking wise action. It's just not, okay, let me just pray. And he could have, you know, prayed for the dog, but he actually moved himself into activity where there was a change, a shift of relationship. So, of course, it may be a little easier with dogs than with human beings. But it's possible. Wherever it's possible, may we take the action that leads to a sense of inner harmony and peace. So this is quite poignant, that we can move from habit mind, from tension, from really being exhausted in trying to fight against life, against ourselves, to open to it and release the tension. So this is the message for tonight. As our spiritual growth really is reinforced, there's no doubt that what we do for ourselves benefits the world. It cannot be otherwise. It cannot be otherwise. And this is just so amazing, right? As we become more peaceful, as we become more kind of quiet, tranquil, happier, balanced, equanimous, we can naturally offer this happiness to the world. And it can be done. It's a possibility. The more we have this wonderful capacity to feel that it matters to this one person, it matters to this one person, small actions. One drop of water in the bucket is one more drop of water in the bucket. As Gandhi said, I believe if one person gains in wisdom and kindness, the whole world gains that much. And if one person fails, the whole world fails to that extent. So it's all in our hands, and it does take engagement and naturally a certain quality of responsibility, that we are not the victim of circumstances. If we rise up to the situation, we can change. And by changing, as Gandhi says, it changes the field within which we're living. So I'll end with Pema Chodron's quote. She says, if we want there to be peace in the world, we have to be brave enough to soften what is rigid in our own hearts, to find the soft spot and stay with it. We have to have that kind of courage and take that kind of responsibility. That's the true practice of peace. Find the soft spot and stay with it. Let's sit for just a minute, just to take in this aspiration.